A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and the author of Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls. If you're planning on getting this book for someone as a Christmas present, you can order it through the Margate Bookshop and request a personalised inscription. I will write a special dedication to the gift recipient. Or if you're buying from your local independent bookshop, I can send a personalised bookplate. Just tell them I sent you and we'll get it organised. On the subject of signed books, Your Book listeners can pre-order an exclusive signed copy of my new novel, Careering, from waterstones.com. It's an office-based romantic comedy where the love interest is the job itself, and it's coming in March. It's for everyone who's ever said, I love my job, but wondered why it is that jobs often don't seem to love us back. Now, on to today's guest. Yersa Daly Ward is a poet and memoirist. She co-wrote Black is King with Beyoncé. Her book, The Terrible, won the Penn Ackley Prize, and we're talking to celebrate her beautiful new book, The How, Notes on the Great Work of Meeting Yourself. Yersa and I talked about being enthralled to Jeanette Winterson, adopting books found on other people's doorsteps, and the books that are so good we need physical and audio copies. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and congratulations on The How, which is just beautiful and brilliant, and it feels like the book I've been waiting my whole life for.
Oh my God, thank you so much. That's so kind.
It's just so nourishing. And I know, well, I've read interviews where you've talked about the strangeness of the last 18 months.
Wow.
And writing something that, where writing what is needed, and it really does feel like what is needed.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. Thank you.
So I really love the way you share your work, and I know you talked about making it accessible, and I was wondering about any other writers or poets or voices that you've discovered online, you know, on Instagram or anywhere that you've really loved and connected with and want to talk about.
You know, a lot of the people I admire, I've admired for years, and I tend to, because I share a lot of my work online, I tend to not hang around online a lot because it's a lot of time spent on online, and I don't want to be staring at that rectangular box too much.
Yeah.
But a lot of the writers I admire and go on admiring are Jeanette Winterson, Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, their facility with language and the way that they say things, the way that they construct sentences, Chimamanda, even like Roald Dahl growing up, the way that language is used. I'm so obsessed with just looking at how somebody has interwoven an experience and distilled it onto the page.
Wow, I mean, so right there are some, you know, big names and exciting names.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and unpick a little bit. I'd love to hear, maybe if we could start with Jeanette Winterson, I'd love
wow.
to know how and where you met her and the first book that you read and where you discovered it and where you felt that connection.
Sure. I've got a few things to say about that one. So initially, the first book that I read, I was about 18 when I found it, and it was Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. And when I read that book, I was so excited because, first of all, that super religious upbringing, the very, very sort of, I want to say sheltered, but it's much more smothering than that even, that she had with her, that Jeanette Winterson had, that the author had with their mother. And I don't know how Jeanette Winterson identifies, so I just want to be mindful of that one. But yeah, that whole experience, and it it felt as though I could tell the truth about where I was from and what I have experienced, because I grew up in a similar household, a very, very strict and religious household, particularly for my sort of early years. And when I read Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, there were such parallels with that and my own life that I just felt so empowered to be able to talk about things that I didn't think, frankly, you were allowed to talk about. But there was someone else having these experiences, and it was so deeply exciting to me.
I think it's definitely one of those books that almost challenges and messes with the structure of what you think is allowed to be in a story and what a story should be. And even though I think she writes, you know, almost sort of classically in terms of the, you know, the beauty of language and the sort of the formality of the beats of the story, there is still that really exhilarating, exciting feeling of being, not being challenged, but also being liberated and, you know, given permission at a time when no one's giving you permission to do anything.
Right. And there's a certain type of truth telling that is just so seductive. And again, I found Written on the Body on some stall. The first time I ever went to New York, it was on some stall. And my friend said, that's a really good book. So I bought it. But I was not prepared for the beauty in the pages. And when I read that book, I went straight back to the beginning and read it a second time. I remember reading it on the L train, just going back and forward on the L train, because I was in New York visiting my friend. And I just fell deeply for that book. And I feel that way about a lot of the author's work.
I love that idea. It's almost like a romance, isn't it? The chance sighting of just seeing it out in the open, not, you know, outside a bookshop as well.
For sure, for sure. And just how a book finds you as well. How a book finds you. And I love to choose books based on a feeling in the moment. There are some books that I'm thinking about for a long time, and then I'm like, okay, It's time. I need to get this book and that book. But there are also those books that just find you. A lot of the time where I live, people leave them outside the houses for people to just take in boxes. And I find a lot of books that way as well.
Oh, so tell me about what you found in the boxes through rummaging.
Oh, my goodness. So my latest one is Boy Snow Bird by Helen Oyeyemi. And I also found, I found a few books that way, actually. I also found a really incredible illustrated book of Gulliver's Travels, and it's beautiful. It's on the top shelf of my bookshelf. And also Little Weirds by Jenny Slate. And also, the Ta-Nehisi Coates book, Between the World and Me, was also found in Brooklyn.
Oh, your neighbours have great taste.
They do, they do. And it's so huge, Brooklyn, that you find people of varying tastes. So it's a very full area.
If you want another link in the coincidence chain, Helen Oyeyemi was, we've had her on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, talking about her new book, Pieces, which is incredible.
Wow, I can't wait. That this was also the first book of hers that I'm in it now. I'm about a quarter of the way through it. And wow. I wish I'd found her sooner, but it's always the right time, I suppose.
It's true, and I think that's a lovely feeling as well. It almost takes you back, doesn't it? To have that sort of, you know, to want it so much your past self.
Yes.
But I think with her there's something so gloriously immersive, and, you know, like being in an underwater world. Is it a hard book to break away from and look up from?
Sure, it is. And I love that. I love to fall deeply, so deeply inside it, that even when you do have to stop, you're thinking about it and you want to get back to it. Also, it's just such a page turner. You're wondering, okay, what is going to happen here? And it's so mystical and a little bit frightening and funny and all of these things wrapped in the one book.
So I know you mentioned, and I've read, that you had a very sort of specifically religious upbringing, and there were lots of rules around sort of, you know, who you could be and what you could, you know, the culture you could consume, for want of a better word. What were the really early books that you found, even sort of before you were 18? Was there anything that kind of crept through and really made an impact?
So many books. That, I will be honest and say that was the golden age of reading, because that was when I was discovering it. And were it not for those days, I wouldn't be a writer. And I honestly, Daisy, I read everything. I read everything. I read Spike Milligan, which I have my poetry to thank. And Spike Milligan, The Bible, and Roald Dahl are the reasons that I infuse my writings with poetry and slip from one form to the next, because I read things like James and the Giant Peach and saw there was this incredible novel, this fantastical, poignant, incredible novel that also broke into song and broke into poetry and did things that were just so hilarious and deep. And so I would say a lot, probably the whole of Roald Dahl's back catalogue. Definitely poets like Spike Milligan, Roger McGough. I read all of those things at a really, really early age. And then my mum had all kinds of romance novels too. And she had the Kama Sutra. I looked at everything when I was young. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And she had an illustrated version of it. And I just remember being just so fascinated. But not only that, she had medical journals, and I would just read anything I could get my hands on.
And I think the incredible thing about the Kama Sutra, when we talk about, you know, what you discover at a young age, and I was absolutely that kid who just wanted to get my hands on the rudest book, or the most explicit book, or the most banned-looking book. But of all the things that, you know, a kid could pick up, it's probably not so bad, is it? I mean, it's very sort of, as far as I know the work, which I will confess isn't, you know, in great detail, you know, it's about sort of, you know, shared pleasure and yeah. about two people. And it's not, you know, so often the narrative really objectifies and hurts and harms women. And it yes. seems much more balanced than that.
It was. And the version that my mother had was so beautiful. And the drawings were almost hand-painted. And yeah, it was just so natural. Nothing, it didn't feel bad. It just felt like, oh, what's this? Oh, okay. And yeah, she had a lot of books like that, and a lot of classics, and just so many different things. And I think that helps as well to build a wealth of curiosity in a young mind, to be interested in everything, not just
Definitely.
Romance, or not just what we call children's books. Not suggesting that all children should read the Kama Sutra, but there were so many things that my mother had that helped me understand people and help me understand, even because my mother was a nurse, so she had a lot of books on biology and nursing and plants and everything like that, and medicines. And yeah, I just grew to be interested in a large range of things.
And it's so interesting the way you were surrounded by all of that work that's about how we care for each other and how we care yeah. for ourselves. And that's now what you were writing, I suppose, and it's a different area.
But yeah. Yeah, I suppose it is. I suppose it is. I hadn't looked at it like that, but I guess everything is connected to the other thing as well.
Mm. No, I absolutely agree there. I was thinking about Roald Dahl and Spike Milligan too, and I suppose how they are, you know, they're both written for adults as well, but those writers that, as children, there's not that sense, you know, there are lots of books that you are given as a kid and you're like, well, no, this is for you and only you. And, you know, this is something that you'll grow out of. And I don't think they're voices that you do grow out of, because adults are so exhilarated by that, you know, silliness and just the joy in using language for language's sake. And what I remember about those writers in particular was being quite, you know, nerdy and being a reader. They made being a reader cool, which helped me, but it also really helped me in terms of surviving the playground and yeah. having a point of connection with the cool kids who thought I was odd.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely wasn't a cool kid, and just very, there was a shyness to me. I mean, that doesn't really go away, but there was this shyness and this sensitivity. And there you are seeing it inside of people, grown people that you're reading about, and it helps you feel less alone.
Mm. I suppose that brings us back to Jeanette Winterson a little bit, but are there any other people in characters in books where you've really connected with that sense of them having an interior life that's very different from what they're presenting to the world?
Sure. Well, I felt that a lot with a lot of Alice Walker's characters because of how she unflinchingly writes about women, the lives of women in terms of their sensuality and hidden desire. Not always hidden desires, but I see it with Celie in The Colour Purple. Her desire was often, I mean, she was blocked. She was controlled in a lot of ways, but she still had this rich interior life. And then I would say that of the characters in By the Light of My Father's Smile as well, just this burgeoning, blossoming interior sensuality, which is just so... I was 18 when I read that book and I just felt like I'd discovered a whole new world, you know? And yeah, same with Toni Morrison's characters in Sula, in Beloved. It was really important for me to read those books at the time that I found them.
Sounds like a really powerful experience and quite a moment in terms of, you know, your own maturity, like something very specific you can point back to and say, yes, that was the time and that was the book.
Yeah, because I spent so much of my early life, well, first of all, I was trying to fit in because I lived in Chorley in the Northwest and I looked like I do. I was the only black girl there. And so much of my time was spent trying to blend in or not be seen. And then on top of that, I had a really religious home life because I was living with my grandparents, not my mother. I had to live with my grandparents from the age of 6. And my grandparents were the super religious ones. And of course, so at home, I had to behave a certain way. And there was there was many years and a lot of experience of not being myself or being quieter or being silent. Mm. So when I found these women in these books and I understood that what I felt was not unprecedented, what I felt was what people feel, that brought great comfort.
And you could really hear it in your voice when you talked about Celie, and I suppose that's the difference, that to have your own secret private world and your own sexuality and sensuality, and that feels like something precious and independent. It's not that it's something that's being repressed or held back, like a happy secret, something you don't necessarily owe it to anyone to share.
Yeah, absolutely. And to have a rich interior life is just one of the biggest joys of existence, I think. Yeah, and it helps your art because there's something there and there's always something to put onto the page or something to share.
And I think broadly writers fall into two camps, and I've spoken to writers who feel that they can't have any voices in their head other than their own when they're writing and when they're getting down to it. And other writers, and I think this is the way I feel, where there can't not be something. And ideally, you know, what they're reading and who they're reading feels very, very different from what they're working on. But they need, you know, that's where the, you know, it's the petrol for the tank. They need to keep topped up. Can you read, if not like when you're writing, during the writing periods?
Yeah, and I think it's important for me to do so. Because we're always collecting information, and it's not that you read a paragraph and you write that paragraph out. It's the chain of events that it's the chemical reaction. It's what happens in your brain as a byproduct of that paragraph, and it might not have anything to do with that paragraph. It might be like the paragraph is about gold, but then there's something that massages something warm or something shining in you. And then you write about a completely different thing. But to me, reading books is like having an awesome conversation where then you go and write a poem off the back of the conversation. It's not that you're taking anything verbatim or even that you're talking about the same subject. It's what it massages inside of you. and I don't know how to say that in a clearer way, but yeah, I think it's important. I think it's juice.
I love that idea of it being a massage. I think that's fantastic. And I'm always going to think of that now. And sometimes I have moments where I think, well, you know, you can just pick like any mentor you like. You don't have to know them. And they don't even have to be, you know, still alive and with us. But any book you read, it's a communication. And there's something that that author can help you to unravel or deepen or strengthen.
I love that it's a communication. It really is. It really is, because something is happening, you're responding to it.
I don't know if you've been asked this a lot, but I was thinking about following the work that you did on Black is King. Are there any books or texts that you'd really love to adapt to the screen in some way, or anything you're working on that you're allowed to talk about?
You know, one thing that I learned the last year and a half is that I actually really enjoy adapting things. I love the idea of adapting shorter stories. I love the idea of, I mean, even adapting a Jeanette Winterson book. I would feel under a lot of pressure because her books are incredible. But there are so many, because they're just so rich with imagery, and sometimes they describe parallel lifelines, different timelines, and I think that's so interesting. And I like work that investigates that, that investigates the fluidity of time.
Please adapt Jeanette Winterson. I would love it so much. Which one will you do?
Oh my goodness. Well, I've named two of them that I love, but honestly, the one that, it's hard to say which book has had the most impact on me, but I love Sex in the Cherry, because it's stories within stories within stories, which is my absolute weakness. But honestly, I could adapt anything that's written. I like things that are rich in imagery and not necessarily linear. So, and there are so many, Samantha Hunt writes like that. There are so many people who do this in such a glorious way.
Can you tell me about Samantha Hunt? Because I don't know her at all.
Samantha Hunt has a book called The Seas. And that was another book that I fell in love with just because of the way it described love, alcoholism, mania, just so many things, depression. But it's the imagery that's so rich in that book. And I will say that is, I just find it so glorious to read about very everyday feelings, emotions, mental states, but described beautifully.
I'm just having a sneaky Google of that now, because that sounds so far up my alley. And I really love anyone writing well about addiction and just that the way that for as long as we've been alive, humans have trying to find, you know, short and long-term fixes for having too many feelings and being, you know, what we do when we're frightened of our feelings. And anyone who's able to write and share about what it is to just allow the feelings and sit with them and know there is no cure for our emotions, I think it's one of the most generous things a writer can do.
Yeah, it is. It is. And who shies away from romanticising? If you have to have a feeling anyway, why not write about it beautifully?
You do, but I think this is definitely, you know, a very old idea and it's really changing. But I think about the sort of, you know, the cult of Hemingway and the sort of, oh, you know, to be a writer is to be a drinker and, you know, have all this sort of this constant pain and that this, and the sort of, and the worse things get, the more you have to write about. Yeah, I think that's a very old idea, but I think when I was younger, I definitely saw the, you know, romanticize that sort of emotional torture.
I do believe that when you have experienced something that's so deep and that has a lot of depth to it and that's shadowy, and if you survive it, then you can make glorious work from it. I don't think you have to stay there. I definitely don't.
In fact,
I feel that when you stay there, it's harder to write because, or maybe it's not harder to write, but it's harder to write with any consistency and to treat this like something you show up for. Because how do you show up for anything when you're in the depths of depression or addiction? It's really difficult. People have done it, but it has, you know, that there gets to be a time when you can't do it anymore. It has a short shelf life.
It's not the feelings that are the problem. It's the numbing, isn't it? And I think it must be very, very hard to write well when you are so overwhelmed that you're choosing to numb yourself.
It must be. It must be hard to show up for it each day. And unfortunately, inspiration is only a small percentage of writing a book. The larger percentage is writing the book and sitting there every day. And really, I can think of nothing that's better than to be in good health writing a book, because there's so much difficulty to the whole thing anyway. There's so much difficulty with production and having it out and everything like that. There's a sense of it being anticlimactic and everything like that. So please be healthy when you're doing it, so at least you can feel your feet on the ground.
I need to repeat that. There is nothing better than to be in good health writing a book. I am going to have that framed in a 96-point type, and I'm going to look at that and think about it every day.
I need to get it framed as well.
I think publishing a book might be the opposite of writing a book, or at least close to the opposite.
Oh, it surely is. It sure is. And while I love all aspects of the book making process, it's very different. There are several different hats.
And what you were saying about, you know, sharing work online and, you know, Instagram especially, but also knowing in your bones that you can't be both the poster and the viewer, that there are too many sort of avenues to get, you know, sucked into and sucked down, and the posting and the sharing is hard enough. I thought that was very, very wise and very resonant.
Yeah, you'll get lost, and then next thing you know, it's mid-afternoon or late afternoon and you haven't written anything, and I can't afford to do that. I also have to write while the morning glow is still on my head. As the day gets later, it is more difficult for me to write in, to be in the space that I am in for writing. The later part of the day, if I am working, it's for things like fixes. It's for things like doing things like problem solving, but it's not for that stream. It's different. The consciousness is different when the sun goes down, I think.
I read Elizabeth Gilbert saying that when she's writing, she gets up to about 5 a.m. or 4 a.m. And it's needing to be doing it when she knows no one's going to ask her anything.
Yeah, it's really important. What I'm learning as well is, well, I learned this, I would say, a couple of years ago. When you live in America, but you work in England as well, you can't turn your phone on because you're going to wake up and then... I meditate before I do anything, but you're going to wake up and then you're going to have all of these emails and updates saying, well, can you confirm this? And are you free then to do that? But if you start to answer, and I would naturally answer because I'm like that. If I get a question, I want to answer it. I'm not somebody who... But you just can't. You just can't if you're going to then write, because it's there's so many of them. And then before you know it, you spent 2 hours replying to emails, and that's your writing time. Your head's in a totally different place. And I have to really consciously do it because I do wake up to those emails. So, yeah, the phone has to be off.
I'd love to hear more about when and how you meditate and, you know, when you found that practice.
I found the practice a few years ago. What I realised, though, is that I've always done it. Even as a child, I used to just lie in blades of grass and look at the sky, and my mind would be clear, a lot clearer than it is now, because I managed a lot of stillness as a child. I really, really did. And it's the first thing I do when I wake up. it's not always easy because I'm thinking, oh, I've got to do this and this and this. But it's important to get that stillness before going out. And then the second thing I do is go for a walk, and then I come back and write.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We'll be back with Yersa soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Everything is Under Control, a memoir with recipes by Phyllis Grant. This is a book I read just before lockdown started, and I think it slipped through the net a little. It is the best kind of comfort reading and comfort eating. Nourishing in places, achingly elegiac in others, it's about food, appetite, womanhood wanting, and New York. Everything is Under Control is published by FSG and out now. Now, back to Yersa.
I was wondering, sort of as a memoirist, which, are there any other memoirs or biographies that you love, that you've really connected with?
Oh, memoirs and biographies. I love Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard. And does it count as a memoir? It feels as though it does.
I don't know that book. Tell me about it.
It's incredible. Oh my goodness. So it's kind of a walk into nature. And the author just talks about where they are in, I'm not sure, I think it's, I want to say Virginia, but I'm not sure. And I just cannot express to you how it feels to listen to this. Every aspect of nature, the trees, the birds, wildlife, is just described, but in just this deep spiritual and intensely visual way.
It sounds really nourishing and recharging and kind of restful.
It is. That's the perfect explanation of that, actually. And I listen to the audiobook version as well quite a lot. Just to, sometimes if I'm on a plane or if I'm just in a situation that is energetically draining or the anxiety is high, just to listen to those words, it's such a balm.
That sounds really glorious. And also, I love that you intuitively know that's what you need during an anxious time or a stressful time. Are there many books where you have the print version and listen to the audiobook version?
So many. It's how I listen to A Little Life. I listen to A Little Life. I have the book, but about maybe, I want to say maybe a 20th through the book, I decided to switch to hearing it by Hanya Yanagihara. And listening to that on subway platforms and going to and from places it was the way I wanted to devour such a huge book as well. It's interesting as well with the voice, because I feel that first of all, you're getting used to the voice, and then the voice just becomes somebody you know.
I would love to listen to that book, something so, you know, intense and painful. Yes. I wonder whether it does feel, you know, that to get the warmth of it, because I think it is a book that in the best kind of way just feel quite isolating in places to have someone telling you. And as you say, the more you hear that voice, because you get a lot of book for your buck, you feel like it's a person you know.
You do. You really, really do. And the same with On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. I listened to that one as well. I have the book, but I listened to that book.
Oh, I'm desperate to read that. That's been on my pile for an embarrassing amount of time. But maybe now I'll listen to it. What's that like to hear read?
It's so interesting because I get torn. Sometimes if a book is mainly... if a book is very plot-based and it's sort of this happened and this happened and it's sort of thriller or... then I tend to love listening to it. If a book has gorgeous sentences like that one, I tend to want to read it because of the way I take in information. And I reading is such... it's such a visceral act to me, just seeing the letters and the ink in the book and seeing the even the dent it makes in the pages. It's something really... it can be tactile. So with Ocean Vuong's work, often I like to read it as well. There are times when I listen and read along at the same time for the maximum impact. So it depends whether I want to hear the voice in my own voice or not. Want to hear the words in my own voice or not.
Because that makes me think of being a little girl at Mass and, you know, listening to a priest or, you know, doing a sort of call and response, but reading in the Mass books or in the sheet what I was hearing and what I was saying. It's quite, you know, it's sort of intensely spiritual doing two at once.
It is. And I was just thinking, as you were saying that I like to ingest poetry by reading it, simply because I like to see the line breaks. I don't necessarily want the line breaks to be... I don't necessarily always want to be read to, but then when I'm sharing my work, a lot of people say they prefer to hear it. So, it's interesting. I guess we're all different in that way, how we process information.
And when you write, does that feel like the complete communication to you? You're not... do you ever... are there any particular poems that you've written and thought, this needs to be told, this is something that people need to hear? Or do you feel like your relationship with the page is very different and specific from sort of your relationship with the idea of a recital or a performance?
I honestly feel as though the poem becomes something else, and neither one is better or worse. The poem just becomes... it's one thing read and it's another one on the page. And when performing them, I change the way that I speak them, depending on how I feel that day. But I think it's just it's almost a different language. Mm. It's the same poem, but it isn't. And I like that. I like to go between. It's a bit like setting a song to a new arrangement.
Oh, I love that. You know, just, you know, bringing different things to life in so many ways. I suppose it's... I don't know if it's sort of offensive to think of, you know, your work as a child of yours or something you have produced. And I don't have any children, but sometimes I compare bits of the writing process to birthing. But that you're birthing different children, depending on how you read something and how you've written it, and all, you know, one sort of constantly pulsing, evolving.
You thing. Are. And I try to tell myself that when I have books out and I think, well, I would do it different if it was today. And I think, well, they're not supposed to be different. They're supposed to just be what they are. And then if you want to improve something, you do that in the next book. And it's not actually that deep. You have a book out. Maybe it wasn't exactly the book that you intended to write, but that's okay.
And if you want to be a writer of books, you wouldn't want the first one or the second one or the third one or the fourth one to be perfect, because then what do you do?
Then what do you do, indeed? Then everyone says, oh, we preferred her at the beginning of her career, or their career, or his career, you know. Yeah, there's no perfection anyway, no matter how long you spend on a book. There are books that I think have come quite close, though.
Which, are there any books that you haven't mentioned that you think are...
oh, there are close so to... many books that I just adore. When you were talking about memoir, the Ta-Nehisi Coates book, Between the World and Me, and I think sometimes a book just gets you. It's not that the book is perfect, but a book just gets you where you are right now, and you think, I would only want to read this right now. And the same with Heavy by Kiese Le Mon. Just the weight of it, no pun intended, because the book's called Heavy, but there's just so much in that and in the Ta-Nehisi Coates book that it stings, you know, the reality of what they're talking about, and yet these authors just have such beautiful language.
It sounds as though they're both books that really make you feel,
yes,
as much as they make you think, and that, yes, it's that feeling that you want to climb back into.
It's absolutely the feeling. I remember walking through Burgess Park and I was listening along with Ta-Nehisi. I was listening to Ta-Nehisi because that was a book that I read and listened to depending on what I was doing. So when I go for my park walks, I would just listen to him. And there were parts, particularly at the beginning, that I was just, my eyes would just be full of tears because of how he was speaking to his son, and these letters to his son were just so resonant.
I mean, I think that's very telling, isn't it? A book that you cannot be away from. Yeah. So if it's not in your eyes, it must be in your ears.
I love that. That's so true. That's so true.
Am I right in thinking that so far you've written, you know, poetry and memoir and nonfiction, but you've not yet written a novel? And is that something that you will do you think?
Oh yeah, and I'm currently working on something now, and I'm seeing what it is changing shape in front of me. But every book that I write is going to be different. There won't be another How, there won't be another Bone. It will just always be different. And absolutely, I mean, when I started writing as a young girl, they were all novels, they were all fiction. And that's what I believe that I'll return to.
I think it's so hard when you really love stories and when that's the thing that you start doing and the thing you think you will do and the thing you want the most. I mean, I definitely felt that I was just so frightened of trying to write a novel and not doing it for a long time. Until I wrote one, it was safer not to try and risk not being able to do the thing I most wanted to do.
I don't think I fear it, but only because I know that a novel nowadays, it meets you where you are. So your novel can be a collection. I've read so many different types of novels that just defy convention. And that's where I feel the most free. And maybe I write something and it does become like a more of a conventional novel, but just knowing that you have space, I think, empowers.
Definitely. Did you read, I was thinking when you were talking about audiobooks, No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. It really isn't written as a novel as we know it, and it does feel like poetry in places, and it's not linear, and it's overwhelming, and it's not got the shape that we recognise, but I think it's brilliant.
I've been writing this down while you've been talking about it, that I want to read that book. That is on my book. That is on my to-read list. No One Is Talking About This. But I can imagine it must be hard to read books that are not written in a sort of regular form, if you will. Just because where you would normally pause, the bits that you would normally weave together are not woven together, and there's sort of a lot of staccato and run-on sentences, and it can be hard. Even reading The Terrible for audiobook, I came against that, and I was like, oh, okay. So it had to be read in a more conversational way.
I mean, I would have imagined that as, you know, you're an actor and a performer and you do so many different things, that compared with most authors tasked with reading the audio for their book, that you'd be like, yeah, I've got this down, I know what I'm doing, I'm on it. Were you nervous about it before, or as you were reading it, did you think, oh, this is actually not quite what I thought it would be?
No, I'm never nervous about reading my work because I know I understand it the most. And so I would say that acting, any kind of performance, because I used to be a singer as well, I would say that any kind of experience with that means it's absolutely 100% easier So when I go to a studio to record like an audiobook, I know it's going to only take a few hours, because there are just certain things that you know, like you know how to correct yourself. You know when something doesn't sound right. You know you don't necessarily have to be told, and I enjoy it because I get to. It's another chance to present the work. It's another because it matters how you say a sentence. It matters if your voice falls, or if you get quieter, or if something's more intense, or if you. You know, if you go fast and then you want a lot of energy, it makes such a difference. And I love just deciding in the spur of the moment what it's going to be. And it would never be the same again if you did it. But if you did it again, but I've just actually 2 days ago did the one for the How. And I was tired when I got home, though. It's tiring working with your voice.
I bet it's intense to kind of to go back and, you know, reprocess and rediscover and to, you know, tear through all that, the work that was, you know, so many months and hours and, you know, days of concentration and thinking to just, you know, go rattle through it in a day.
Yeah, and sometimes you think, why did I write it like this? Why did I put that word there? But, you know, there it is. So...
As you said, maybe in a way writing is much more like a performance than we know, that we think we can just go back and change and change and change, but at a point we have to sort of say no, that's where the rhythm of it fell that day. We just have to make our peace with that.
I'll tell you something, it is for me, it is like a performance for me, because sometimes I don't remember what I've written. I do with poetry. I can quote my lines in poetry more or less straight away from memory, but I will say that with these longer works, yeah, sometimes I look back at them and I was like, what were you thinking when you wrote this? And yeah, I almost don't remember it. I don't remember being in the moment. And I'm not someone, I don't really edit that much. So I usually keep the first, you know, the first writing, the essence of the first writing, and I'll change words, but I won't change the whole thing. And sometimes I pay for that. You know, I look back at it and I'm like, but there you go. That's part of it, I think.
Did you read much poetry at school? Were there any voices then that you remember? Because I think poetry at school is so odd, because you'd feel... I think it can be a little bit like maths, where you've either got a really great teacher who gets it and wants you to get it, or... it is presented as being something quite daunting, quite inaccessible.
Yeah, I think that if I'd relied on school, I got all my poetry from school, I would definitely never look at poetry again. I would never... I'm so lucky that my mum had me reading books from an early age, because I will say that school, particularly high school, because in primary school you still have really cute poems and just amazing stuff. But I will say the poetry that we... were studying at high school was so uninspiring, and so there was just so much of it that felt it didn't feel relevant, it didn't touch my soul, it felt intellectual and just erudite in a strange, very distant way. And also there was no diversity in terms, not at the time when I was learning it, in terms of what we were being shown. So of course we think poetry is that, and of course poetry is not that, it's so many things. Poetry is rap, poetry is manifesto, poetry is copywriting, poetry is prose. But we're not taught that. I was taught a very classical way of doing things. And as beautiful as some of the classics are, that's not all there is. I think it's really difficult, because I think a lot of kids got robbed of that. I was lucky. Again, my mum sat with me and taught me how to read, so it was not difficult. And also, I grew up on the Bible, so there was no archaic language that was difficult for me. I was really ahead with my language. But for people who hadn't had that, of course they weren't going to enjoy poetry, because it's like a different language. And I think that ruined a lot of early, what could have been a romance or an interest in poetry. It well and truly stamped it out, because they couldn't access it.
I think that makes sense. I mean, I remember, you know, feeling, and it feels like a cliche now, but Sylvia Plath and Emily Dickinson, and when the sort of the Emily Dickinson renaissance a couple of years ago, and, you know, sort of teenage girls.
Yeah.
Making quotation marks, my fingers, like, discovering her. And I'm like, yeah, she's so full of feeling. Like, the time to read Emily Dickinson, my God, it's when you're like 12 or 13 and intense. It's all there.
Yes, it really is. It really is. You have to find it, but you also have to have the language and have something that connects you to being there. And you have, it has to be encouraged in young people, because it doesn't make sense even having the material, but then they live in an environment where such things aren't encouraged anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's a 360 thing. And that's why it's important to talk to younger people, to engage them, to listen to what they say, because it all makes sense. And that's how we, that's how we get our next generation of artists, by encouraging these things.
It's some version of, it's the same as having the book and listening to the audiobook.
Yeah.
You need to be able to have this everywhere you go.
Absolutely.
I was curious about what you said about growing up the Bible as well, because however problematic or not it is as a text, it's so full of these really big, vivid stories. And I think that if you're a little kid who knows the Bible, you know imagination. There's space in your brain for the hugest universes.
Yes, there is. And once you can believe that someone turns water into wine, and there's a technical, a dream coat, and people are walking around with angels. Really, I mean, your mind is just so fecund at that point. Of course you can create whole wide worlds, tongue twister. Of course you can create that, because you believe the other things. Or you have been taught the other things by people who believe them. And that means something. Whatever we want to say about the Bible, it means something. It's a place for your brain to be.
Definitely. As a reader, do you like being kind of challenged or being scared? Those stories that have that kind of, that dimension and that, you know, sense of what is possible and what's terrifying. Or, you know, when you're sort of rereading, are you looking for comfort and resolution to some degree?
No, I don't need the resolution, because that's all interior. I love that some things do make you think, and I love the unsafe. It's weird, I don't actually watch horror films or anything like that, because I just don't want to pay to stress my body out. But in books, I can read more or less anything. Yeah, I want to be challenged. I want to come face to face with some of those things that I fear or have thought about. And I can definitely read about things a lot more than I can see them or hear them. It's where I make sense of the world. It's where I feel the strongest.
Weirdly, when a book has that, you know, sort of the darkness and the fear and the ambiguity, I think sometimes it can be scarier than anything. When you put something on a screen, there's no ambiguity there. It flattens it, whereas a book can haunt you in all ways.
That's why I feel that they have to resort to, you know, all the loud sudden bangs that make you jump, which I hate, by the way.
Yeah.
in the theatre. But yeah, I much prefer something chilling, or something that leaves you with questions afterwards, and something that you, because that's when something is truly unsettled you. Whereas with some of those films, you've forgotten it as soon as you've watched it. You watched it and you had the scary sort of thrilling moments, but then it's out of your body hours later.
So on that theme, have you got any suggestions for subtly scary books? Or
there are some now the author's name, let me get it actually up so I can read it, because I don't want to get it wrong. But there's The Dark Dark by Samantha Hunt. Some of the stories in Alice Walker's collected stories are actually like that. There is a book called, let me find it. So it's by Carmen Maria Machado, and I hope that I've pronounced the author's name. And there are two books that I read that have that element to them where you're like, oh, Her Body and Other Parties, that's one. But the other one that really chilled me, and it's a memoir, it's about real life, is called In the Dream House.
I have that. I've not read it yet. I bought it just before I moved house from the Deal Bookshop, which is near me.
Good book. Especially if you've had a situation similar to that. It's a good book.
The impression I get, is this right, is that it is a memoir, but it has got that a sort of shifting, non-linear vibe, that it's not a sort of an and then.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely a memoir, but the way that it describes this relationship is frankly frightening in some ways. In a way that you see coming and you also don't. And I think that's truly chilling. So I really, really enjoyed. That was one that I listened to and took it everywhere.
Oh, does she narrate it?
She does.
Oh, so do you know what's next on your list for audiobooks?
Yeah, I can tell you right now because I have it on my Audible. So there are a couple of things. I don't know if this book has actually been released on Audible. So I've just listened to a couple of books by Awake Emezi, and I just listened to the... Is it The Death of Vivek? There's a couple that I've just listened to. So there's Fresh Water. And then I think there's the... I don't know if it's The Life of Vivek or Audio The Death of Vivek. Or incredible. Just, I love the way that this writer talks about things and how they describe things. Again, in that way it can be chilling. It can be chilling, and they're only describing the way that somebody feels about something, but it hangs around. It stays with you. And I love when writing does that.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah, I love that. The feeling of being claimed
by a book. Yeah, yeah. And when a book just settles there and just says, no, I know you wanted to do that, but don't you just want to finish me tonight? Can I be your plan for tonight? And usually I'm like, yeah, of course. I didn't have to do anything more interesting than finding out what happens. And again, the book, Nothing to See Here, also weirdly chilling, but super cool at the same time. I've just looked at my Audible and I have 4 credits, so I'm really excited.
Oh,
yeah.
Excellent.
Because I get so many sometimes that I'm a bit behind with them, but I love that.
I'm very excited. Stay in touch and let us know what you
get. I will.
I'm very sad to hear. I think we're at time, but it's been so lovely to talk to you, and I could talk to you about books for days.
Same.
And I'm so excited about sending The How to everyone I know and love. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a really lovely day.
And you too, Daisy.
I hope we speak again one day.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And if you think of any, if you really, really enjoy any books, please drop me a line, let me know, because I'm always just so interested in what people are reading and when and why. And yeah.
Huge thanks to Yersa. The How is out on the 11th of November, and I loved it. It's a compassionate, magical manifesto. It's a call for creative tenderness, and it's a perfect present for anyone beloved in your life who isn't afraid of a little woo. Don't be. I'm woo too. You can follow us at WhyBooked on social media. Look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests, and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends, and thanks so much to everyone who has left a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and their new favourite books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Yersa, acast.com/booked, and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from Anita Bruckner. I suppose what one wants really is ideal company. And books are ideal company. See you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.